We'll do it live! Fuck it!
Got it. Okay. All right, Mike, let's shoot away.
All right, I'll just count down 3, 2, 1. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Half-Guarded Hour here at HalfGuarded.com. I'm Mike Coughlin, and my guest right now is a man that does not need an introduction. If you don't know who he is, I don't know why you're listening to this, because this is a website about mixed martial arts, and Dan the Beast Severn is pretty much one of the most important people that ever competed in the sport. Dan, thank you for taking your time out of your day to do the show. How are you doing?
Well, Mike, I'll tell you what, I'm doing phenomenally. I just got done doing a practice. I was able to torture people for the last hour and a half. I'm feeling effervescent.
You know, I have all these notes, but you said that, and I just have to ask right out of the gate, how are you in such good shape? How does this happen? Like my old man passed away at the age of 63, and he looked like he's on death's door for a decade, and I see you everywhere, and I think, holy cow, you're in way better shape than I am. I'm like 20 years your junior, at least.
Yeah, let's put it right there, Mike. I am 58 years of age. I don't look my age, and well, nor do I act my age. So I have been involved in, I'd say, organized sports since 1969. I started my journey, I should say, in amateur wrestling. I did a few things before that, like basketball, baseball, all those kinds of things right there. But I finally kind of felt like amateur wrestling was the route for me to go. So that's a lot of decades doing one sport. You know, from going from amateur wrestling to, by the 1992 Olympics, professional wrestling, to, by 1994, cage fighting. I refer to that because most of your listeners don't even know what NHB means. They just know, they know the terms MMA for mixed martial arts, but the predecessor that started off in 1994 through the Ultimate Fighting Championship was known as NHB, otherwise known as No Holds Barred. Biggest difference between the two divisions of MMA has roughly 46 or 47 rules, where MMA had two. Those being no biting, no eye gouging, end of the rules. Let your imagination go wild, the end of the rules, of all the things you can do without ever violating those two rules. So the things you could do to another human being, and they were done. No weight classes, no time periods, bare-knuckled, and it was an 8-man tournament. And the same 2-hour pay-per-view that still plays today, where men face one opponent on a night, you had to face 3 opponents in the same night. So,
and you,
that's the biggest difference there.
And you won 3 of those tournaments in, I think, like 2 years or something like that.
Well, basically, I won the UFC number 5, I won the Ultimate, and I won the Super Bowl. So literally, those were 3 different classifications. I am the only Triple Crown winner in the UFC's No Holds Barred era. And since it's illegal to do, I'm in a category all by myself.
I was going to get to this later, but it just works really well right now. Having spent so many years in amateur wrestling with, you know, various rules and restrictions on what you could and couldn't do is to your opponent, when you finally got into the cage to fight someone, did you just feel like you were free to use all of, like, the dirty, quote-unquote, illegal techniques of amateur wrestling?
Well, no. It was... I really struggled. UFC number 4 was my very first UFC event, and now what we're doing, we're approaching UFC 200 by next weekend. It was, what was difficult for me is, well, first off, I was a last second fill-in, and I only trained for 5 days, an hour and a half a day. Jeez. Not inside of a cage, because today, in today's world, you can go to almost any community and you can find a cage or a part of a cage inside of a gym, and the gym is promoting we're doing wall tactics. back then, there's only one cage. There's only one by UC. So I would travel 2.5 hours one way from Coldwater, Michigan to Lima, Ohio, to a gym called Body Slammers Gym. A buddy of mine, Al Snow, who owned Body Slammers Gym, a professional wrestling ring is the closest thing that could find to a cage. And I had Al and two other professional wrestling proteges who had one pair of old boxing gloves between the three of them. So one guy would go in there, they would try to punch, kick, do whatever crude submissions they knew how to do, and I basically stayed out there the entire time. They'd throw punches, kicks. I simply just move back, take them down, clinch them, throw them down. Don't slap on amateur wrestling moves. Turn the amateur wrestling moves illegal. Make them scream or squawk, and that was my training camp. When I tell people, I never trained a single legitimate submission or a single legitimate strike. That's blunt, honest. That kind of goes with that title. The realest guy in the room. Because I'm blunt to the point. You find another human being that walks this planet that can make those claims. And the sheer fact that I've had a 20-year career and I've done 2 training camps in 20 years.
Jeez.
I teach classes. I was teaching class. Most of my students are happy if they can hang with the old guy. Because I run a rather robust class. And I simply say, bathroom is there, drinking fountain's there. My number one rule is, you don't puke on my mat. If you puke, you clean it up. I call it, because if I was nauseous, I know it. I'd back off, pick a round or two off. Go get some fresh air. And I actually have had people that have puked on my mat, or they have run out, and they said, you know, they made outside, and they puked in front of my door. I go, you still got clean? You just puked in front of my door. People got to walk in, they got to walk out. I don't want to be walking to puke. We'll finish up with puke there, okay? We're moving on.
Well, you know, it's always good to end on a high note.
High note or a low note?
it's cage fighting. It's a middle note. In a weird way, you're actually you are somewhat responsible for me becoming the man I am today, and I'm sorry to blame you for this.
Uh-oh.
Only because 13 years ago, and I know I'm old now, I was a 20-year-old punk kid. I went to the University of Iowa. No, I didn't wrestle because I couldn't wrestle. But my brother and I had a jiu-jitsu book, and we would go to the wrestling rooms after practice, and we would train submissions. And after a couple months, I thought, I can do fighting? What's the big deal? Like, I can do this. And so I actually fought an amateur fight on one of your Danger Zone MMA shows in Indiana.
No way.
I really did.
Wow.
And I remember the night before the show started, the fight, I was, like, in the bathroom. I was, like, crying. I'm like, what am I doing? This is insane. I'm so stupid. I'm going to get hurt. I come from, like, a middle-class, you know, upper-middle-class background in Chicago. My high school didn't even have wrestling. We had golf. So I'd never been in a real fight. And I get into the cage, and 3 minutes later, all I remember thinking is, I hope I can tap out because I'm getting beat up too much. But I still, that moment, it allowed me to realize I could get beat up and it's okay. Like, I can take a punch and not die. And it was kind of like a changing point in my life. And now I train, you know, I train legitimately with Carlson Gracie Jr. here in Chicago. I have real trainers and all that stuff. But, in a weird way, you kind of changed my life with your Danger Zone.
Wow.
And I know that you've, you know, still run Danger Zone, that you have a 10,000 square foot facility, I think, in Coldwater, and
the name of the training facility is known as Michigan Sports Camp. I always kept that generic because as long as I have instructors, I can teach almost anything here. And I'm the primary instructor, and that's what most people are coming to. Because I can teach the amateur lesson, I can teach the professional wrestling, I teach the mixed martial arts, I teach my flavor submission grappling. Yeah. I teach a youth MMA class, but the MMA does not stand for mixed martial arts. It stands for modern martial arts.
It's
a glorified physical education class, Mike, where if you go to our high schools now, it is sad what they call physical education. It's like physical activities. These kids don't even break a sweat. Oh, they break a sweat, but they have fun. It's heavily gymnastic-based. I always tell people that My class age range, 5 years of age up until right around that sixth grade. Because all I'm doing is I'm developing gross motor skills, fine motor skills, so that now at that sixth grade mark, they should be starting to look at other sports. They should be looking at basketball, baseball, wrestling, and because I do all of those things with them. They learn how to catch. They learn how to throw. They do gymnastics. They'll do karate. They'll do kung fu. They'll do taekwondo. All variations of things. So it's some types of grappling, some types of striking, but it's a physical education class. They love it. Hula hooping. We even do hula hooping there. Mike and yours truly is a hula hoop master.
I never thought I would hear you say those words.
That might not be the visual that you're looking for.
Actually, makes me less scared talking to you, knowing that you've mastered the hula hoop. Because actually, I haven't mastered a hula hoop yet. But that's good. You know, you got to challenge yourself. I imagine once you've basically mastered all of wrestling, mastered mixed martial arts, you need something to do, and I guess a hula hoop's the next logical step.
Well, Mike, I do a lot of appearances at Hooters or Buffalo Wild Wings. Now, Hooters is known for their hula hoop contest. So, the very first time I came in there, you know, a couple of the gals were thinking that they were going to have some shekel-me-yek-yeks at my expense. And they brought out the hula hoop, and they started doing a little bit of hula hoop, and they're like, well, Mr. Shatter, Mr. Beast, what should we refer to? Can you hula hoop? You might be able to do cage flip, but can you hula hoop? I go, what's a hula hoop? I think, what is that there thing, tarnation type of thing? So I played coy until that. And I spun it around a few times, but I had to spin and fall down. Like, how do you do it? So they're all there showing how to do their hip hack stuff like this. And then I kicked it at the high gear and showed them how to hula hoop. I was doing the sprinkler around, rotate and stuff like this. I can't make it really go up and down my body, but I can maintain a hula hoop, maintain a conversation, and do a couple goofy things there with the tour that I'm going. Yep, he was playing possum with us.
I think there is nothing that sums you up better than your competitive instinct is if you're going to do the hula hoop, you're going to beat the girls at Hooters. Not many men would probably be able to say that in their life.
Mike, everything is competition. Life is competition. We compete for the best jobs. We compete for the best significant others. Life is competition. I wake up in the morning going, yes, what new is going to happen? What new horizon shall I climb or something like that today? It's like going into my office. I love seeing what new emails are going to come in because I know I'm going to always have something good in there. I'm a big believer in karma. What you give is what you get, and I'm good with people, and maybe as I get older, but I'm getting wackier and funner type of things being offered to me, and I'm thinking, that's okay, I like that.
That drive to compete, do you think that's something that's kind of just built into you? Because I know you were scheduled to fight Ken Shamrock before he had an injury to his testicles, apparently, earlier this year.
And then... No. Mike.
I'm upsetting you up.
You're being kind there by saying an injury. I just think that he lost the testicular fortitude altogether. The fear, sheer fact that he bowed out 9 days before, and the sheer fact that he took a match before our match was already agreed to, and then he makes his announcement of Bellator and he's fighting Hoist Gracie. Originally, the original date of our fight, whatever Bellator was on a Friday night, our original date was on that Sunday. 2 days later, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. And as soon as I saw that announcement, I contacted the company. I go, are you guys aware that Ken just announced he's fighting Bellator on Friday night? And, like, they're shocked. They didn't know. And so they make this phone call to Ken. Like, hey, Ken, what's up? Ken's, like, really arrogant, saying, hey, no big deal. Move the show back by 1 week. I'll fight Hoist Gracie in 1 weekend, and I'll fight Dan Severn on the following weekend. Does Dan Severn have a problem with that? When they called me back and they said that, I go, well, quite honestly, no. Dan Severn doesn't have a problem with that whatsoever. I'll be there. I'll be ready. But you as a company better be aware that in case Ken gets any kind of little boo-boo, it's a minimum of a 30-day suspension. Minimum! Okay, so they did move the show back, which to me it's like, why move the show back? Tell Bellator to move their show back.
Yeah.
One was already agreed upon before then. But the thing is, then, you know, he bounced out and he says he had to bow out because, you know, his match with Bellator was ruled a TKO, 30-day suspension. I'm like, really? You're supposed to do my match before. You take another match.
Yeah.
Sure, you got one 30-day suspension, but you also are suspended for steroids, tested positive for steroids.
Oh, yeah.
But also tested positive for opiates. It's your second time tested positive for steroids, so you're not going to stand in the corner for just 30 days. It's your second offense. It might be 90 days. It might be 6 months. I don't know. I still don't know how long Ken has to go stand in the corner for.
Well, to be honest,
I
was just going to say, some part of me kind of hopes that he doesn't come back just because I think he's got some real physical issues. And if you're using opioids and steroids and you're getting in the cage, you probably just shouldn't be fighting anymore. Especially, I feel like Ken is just, he's the potential for a really bad ending to a career.
But Mike, I would like to be the person that pushes him over that edge.
Well, you know, if Hoist Gracie can beat you with strikes, I cannot imagine what you would do to Ken Shamrock at this point. I mean, I don't even box, and I think I probably box better than Hoist Gracie does. And I can only imagine what a legitimate world-class wrestler who stayed in shape and always competed would do to Ken Shamrock in his current state.
Well, let's put it away, Mike. That was my third and my final training camp of my career, is what I kind of figured, because I had retired with a clause. I simply said, I'm going to retire now. But if one of these three guys, and right in order, I said I would come back out possibly, or I should say I would seriously contemplate coming back out for a Mark Coleman, a Ken Shamrock, a Hoist Gracie, right in that role. But Mark's off the list because Mark's had an artificial hip replacement a couple of times, and he's had some really health issues. He's probably lucky to be alive now. So, I mean, he's off the list. But, you know, Ken and Hoist are still viable because, you know, they did do a recent Bellator. I even reached out to Bellator. Hey, how can I get to play? Can I have the winner? I even offered Scott a Kmart 2-for-1 special.
Wait, no.
And I couldn't get a taker on that one. Yes, I did.
So you basically offered to fight both of them on the same night or consecutive shows? How would that have worked?
Well, I'd rather do it on consecutive shows, but if my only opportunity is on the same night, I would do the same night. That's a pretty bold statement, isn't it, Mike?
You are the most
bad. But I know, Mike, I'm the realest guy around.
I'm just scared hearing that. What 58-year-old man says, yeah, I'll get in a cage fight with two people younger than me on the same night and probably be the betting favorite to most people to beat both of them in under 5 minutes.
When I watched the, because I did watch the Bellator show, I watched the Hoist Gracie Ken Shamrock match, and then before that I watched the Kimbo Slice Dada 5000 match as well.
Oh, jeez.
And I thought to myself as I'm watching this, I go, not only will I give Bellator a 2-for-1 special, I'll give them a 4-for-1 special. all for the same night as well. But, you know, I probably shouldn't say that now because, you know, Kimball has gone now. And yeah. And I still don't know what the health status is on that dot of 5,000. I just know that he was in the hospital for quite some time because he ended up having a heart attack.
Yeah. It almost seems like something like if someone said that Dana White gave you a bunch of money to go to Bellator and destroy all of their big drawing opponents, people would be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, because you would, again, be the favorite to beat all four of those guys, and you would not just beat them, but make them look bad due to your style of fighting, where they would look incompetent against, you know, I don't want to say old, well, but an experienced grappler.
Yeah, but Mike, I really don't have actually grab anybody else. It's in my final 5 years of competition, I was trying for one last big match hurrah to go out on, because I could tell my skill set is slipping. You know, that is a hard thing for a professional athlete to recognize. I don't want to go against the younger bucks, no. Mm-hmm. I'll go against another old fart, sure. You know, because it's got history, it's marketable. Will it live up to the hype? Heck no. You might have to put in some new rules, like, you know, no hitting the prosthetics, you know, no kinking the oxygen tanks, and, you know, yeah, just. You know, don't need any mouthpieces because you just leave your dentures out on the table.
Oh, goodness.
Unlimited time because it may take a little longer for using walkers to get across to each other. Yeah.
Yeah, you really don't know how scary you still are as a man, do you? Like, you're somebody that I guarantee 95% of the people, if they just saw you in the mall, would be like, even if they didn't know who you are, they'd be like, oh, that guy, he's just tough. You can just look at you and just know, that's a man that knows how to handle himself. He's going to beat somebody down.
Mike, I have never been in a fight in my entire life. But I have been a competitor my entire life. Because to me, it's like, you know, even like Big John McCarthy, he's like, somebody goes, he says, you're that guy who can study the rules and know how to use the rules and beat people and skirt all the issues that they have. There's a couple of rules that they have right now. Even tonight, I'm on my mat. I'm showing them just how to exploit just one of the rules.
Oh, you know what? That brings up something I totally forgotten until just now. Is it true that one time John McCarthy asked you, do you have any questions? And you asked you responded with, if a train is going from Philadelphia to New York is 70 miles an hour, what time will it get there?
It was 60 miles an hour. Oh. Because I've been asked that question so many times. Now, I've had an ongoing relationship with Big John there to where the very first time I was in the cage, John is very professional. You know, he has a law enforcement background, very professional the way he comes up there, and he talks to you, the fighter, first. And then as he gets done going through all this stuff, he looks at you and he's like, are there any questions? Well, first of all, he does to me, I mean, nothing comes to mind, but as he starts to tell me, it just pops in my head and it just pops out of my mouth. I simply said, yeah, where did all that money go that my parents paid for piano lessons? I just said, he turns back to look at me because he heard it. But as he looks back at me, I can tell, he's like, it didn't come from you because I had my game face on him. And the second time, He gives me the point, are there questions? I look at him dead panic. I go, well, you know, I wouldn't be doing this if you just give me the winning lotto ticket numbers. And he dawns on me that it was me who said that first comment. And then he's like, his wife, Elaine, is the travel coordinator at the time for UFC. And he talked to his wife, goes, this guy is nuts. He's cutting one-liners before he's about to throw down into the cage. And then they get to know me, and they realize, no, I'm very calm. I'm very collected on this. I'm calculating here right now. I shake your hand before, I shake your hand after. No hard feelings of what's about to happen. I want to compete, and I want to push rules to the extent of almost breaking them, but I won't break them.
You can't.
I know the parameters about how to move, and that's where John says, he goes, 70, he goes, you're the scariest cat out there because you're out there competing against guys that are trying to take your head off, and you're pulling off one-liners before, after, even sometimes during my match. His wife gave me some dirt on him. At one point in time, Big John was saying a couple comments to me and stuff like that, and I started a conversation with him. And he's 5 years of age. I don't want him any younger than that.
I guess that's probably just comes from a lifetime of competing and the ability to separate yourself from being on the mat and being off the mat. And a lot of guys, especially today, they have to psych themselves up and make it personal and talk trash. And you have that, ability from having been trained probably since you were probably 5 or 6 years old of you compete, you shake hands, and when the match is over, you leave it behind on the mat.
It's done. Exactly. It's done.
I got a bunch of other stuff to talk about. Before any of that, I want to talk about you writing a book. You have a book coming out. I believe it's coming out. Is it July 4th when it debuts?
Well, it should be out, I'll say, somewhere in the next 7 to 10 days. It's what we're trying to do is try to coordinate things. I will be going out to the UFC Fight Week that they have going on. I think I fly in on the 7th. Still the 11th that will be there. There's a Hall of Fame induction on that Sunday. And I think they'll induct one of my proteges, Don Fry, for example. So I'll be there on that Sunday inducting Don Fry. And,
wow.
And then I'll be at the UFC on that Thursday, Friday, and Saturday doing autograph signing of his nature. So I'm trying to get clearance with them. If not through them, I will go to some other, whether at my hotel locations or at some type of a sporting goods store or I should say at the card shop or something like that does collectibles. Somehow I'll get something set up during that week, because what a better week to have thousands of people coming in that like mixed martial arts.
Well, I am sure that Dana White is obviously listening to this. So, Dana, make sure you give Dan a little bit of TV time to push the book, because I have a feeling this is going to be really interesting. What was it like? Why now? Why write the book about your career at this moment in time?
Well, I'll tell you what, Mike, I've been actually writing the book for probably close to 20 years.
Wow.
The problem is I have too much content. I have over 1,000 pages. I mean, the gentleman that helped me do this, Ian Douglas, he helped kind of coordinate things, and he comes from a literary background there. They helped co-write all this. So I should say, I actually wrote it. He just did interview after interview, kind of put into a format that we're hitting as many audiences as possible. I know that there will, more than likely, there will be a book number two and possibly a book number three come after, because I have too much content. Saying that I started amateur wrestling in 1969. I didn't start my professional wrestling career until 1992. I started my cage fighting career by 1994. But, Mike, let's go back on this timetable. So, again, 1969, I start stuff by 1976. I'm the number one recruit in the nation at my weight class. So, 69, I start. I 76, number one recruit in the amateur wrestling. Let's just jump in by two decades. Then by 1996, I'm the number one cage fighter in the world. What's the guy been doing, two decades? I mean, how many people can say they've been competing for 45-plus years? And see, I know, Mike, my goal is, I'm going to go into that fifth decade. I started doing my submission grappling. I'm not done yet. I might have retired from mixed martial arts. I didn't retire in life. I didn't retire from teaching all the seminars or speaking engagements that I do. I like what I do. It brings me life. My better half, she just watched me. She says, "You come alive on that match." It's like, that's like your fix.
No,
you go out there and it's like you come alive. And I go, it is. It's my fix.
Probably in a much lesser way, I know what you're kind of saying, because by day, I'm just a regular practicing attorney here in Chicago, but the moment I step on the mats to roll, nobody knows who I am. Nobody cares I went to 7 years of school. I'm just another guy, and I tap out like everybody else, and I'm just an athlete. A real low-level athlete, but I've won my tournaments here and there, and there is a bit of... I was just going to say, I compete in the Masters division at IBJJF. I do my tournaments. I win some, I lose some, and it just kind of, it really is a weird addiction that I think that if people that don't compete or don't train don't fully understand why it's fun to get up every day, eat right, and you eat right not just because it's good for you, because you know it'll make you better on the mats. And then when you get on the mats and you put yourself in the worst position because you want to get better, and you're okay with getting humbled, and all just to build up for a tournament, and in my case, I have to pay to compete, and I'm happy to do it. And I think there's just a disconnect between people that have that. It's like a drug almost in many respects.
I totally agree with you. I like everything that's said with there. It's in that training element there too. There's an age factor that kicks in, because because you said the word masters, I know that puts you in a little bit older category than the younger bucks.
Yeah,
and that's where that, and I was saying earlier, it becomes more difficult with each passing year to know that I have to settle for this is the best I can do. There was a point in time when I could go into the weight room and I could rack up 505 on a squat rack.
Wow.
And I had to put collars on it because as you stepped away from the squat rack, the whole bar is bending over your shoulders and you squat looking into them and you're like going, yeah. And now that is nothing but a fleeting memory. I can't do that anymore. Now I do a leg press. It's so much easier on my back and stuff like that. I have to listen to my body. I have to train the way it allows me to train. There's some days you wake up and you got this little dip in your step. And you're like, what the heck happened to me during my night's sleep? I'm hobbling with this little limp type thing that's happening now, like keep on moving, and okay, it's working, so yeah, okay, and boom, and we're right back at it. Don't know how that happened, or know it happened, and it worked its way out again, so they'll keep. I tell people that move it or lose it. And that's bad, because a lot of Americans, their lifestyle is, after they're done working, they come home, they eat that big meal, and they anesthetize in front of the boob tube. And the only exercise they'll be doing is the thumb on the remote control.
Yeah, it's funny because, again, I'm only 33, and yet I'm like, I feel like the old guy, because I've been in and out of gym since I was 15 or so. And I remember one time being in a gym and having the older guy say, you need to stretch more. And when you're young, you think, I don't need to stretch. I'm good. And now here I am. If I have a practice, I show up a half an hour early just to stretch in advance because I'm like, I have to stretch my body. I really wish I was smarter when I was younger and had listened to all these old guys that actually know what they're talking about. And now I see it where there's some 20-year-old kid that shows up. He maybe trains for 6 months and he can beat me down. And I just have to accept this is what happens in life. A new generation comes along, and to hear you talk about this as a fighter, and so many, not just a fighter, a high-level athlete, so many athletes don't seem to want to admit that to themselves. You see Alex Rodriguez is 40 years old, still trying to play baseball, and you see boxers trying to fight in their 50s at the high level, and it sounds like you are, you like to compete. You want to do your best, but you're not delusional thinking you're going to get in there and beat Stipe Miocic for the UFC heavyweight championship.
No, if you're exactly right. I'm not even going to flirt with the idea of competing with the young bucks. I know my place in competition. My heydays have come and gone. Now, the ironic part here, Mike, people are like, wow, you were really something back in the day. I go, no, Michael, By the time I stepped into UFC, even in by that 1994, that was called Dan Severn Residue. If you wanted to see an animal, you should have seen me. You should have seen me from 1984 to 1986. I ruled the world, and I mean that in the most boldest sense. People were afraid to walk out on the mat with me. I was so aggressive. Let me give you an idea, Mike. Even in my high school, my last 2 years, each progressive year, I keep up on my ante and my goals. I'm very goal-oriented. If you saw my plan, you still see, I still set goals even now of what I want to do on a personal basis, what I want to do on a business basis, what I want to do, you know, competition, all that kind of stuff. And in my high school, just to give you an idea, I was a 3-time All-American, a 2-time state champion. My junior year, I went 51-0 with 43 pins, and only one person the entire season I did not pin. Now, let me repeat that. 51-0, 43 pins, but only one person I did not pin. The math doesn't add up because all those other guys I beat were by injury default. I was so aggressive that they got hurt in the process of the match. So going into my senior year, my goal was this. I must pin everyone because there's only one person I didn't pin in my junior year. So my goal now is I must pin everyone. So pin everyone to my regulation season. Districts, regionals, states. My final match is coming up. State finals. Most young men would have loved to go on to states. Most would love to have placed at states. The year before, I had pinned my opponent in 48 seconds.
Wow.
The pressure I put on myself was this. I must win. I must pin, I must do it all under 48 seconds. I succeeded. I pinned him in 40.
You're a madman. You know that, right?
No, I'm a driven man. That's what people don't understand. When they, like my training camp here, these guys, they're just, I go, you guys talk. I'm not going to talk. I'm going to do. I always say if you're ever getting to fight and you see a group of men or something, just be careful for the quiet guy. He's the one that's sizing things up, and he's the one that's going to get the job done. I like to be the quiet guy. I'm not going to the barking dog, the one that's making all the noise. They'll never do nothing. I'm just going to speak, man. I'm just going to show you how to do it. Even that, I tell people that I don't know. I have a lot of one-liners, a lot of quotes that I do as I'm still my Severnisms that I go by. But a lot of it is, you know, they just can't get caught up into it. You know, because it's, you know, forget your guy. I had the oldest guy I have in my class right now is 28.
Oh, geez.
And they just want to see, can they hang with the old guy? And the funny part is, I'm like a glorified cheerleader. I'm barking out orders. I'm doing the Ric Flair woos and stuff like this. I get excited. People keep them going there. And no time, they're just like, they're seeing me. Like, yeah, today I put guys through a bag routine. And then in the last three rounds, it was like we're doing an actual fight. Three just two-minute rounds. And, okay, you got to push. And we got to push harder. And now the match is close. And you got to win this match. Just by being aggressive and pushing and winning the judges over with the aggressive nature. And they're just I had a couple of guys that did not make a return visit for tonight. This is actually a 3-day MMA camp. And a couple of the fellas were not able to make it back tonight because they were too sore.
That sounds kind of familiar to me. Is particularly with guys who come from an amateur wrestling background, is the idea that, not that you're mean, but you want to weed out people that are mentally weak. Because everybody will break down physically at one point, but if you mentally can have the ability to show up and even if you know you're going to vomit, you know your legs don't work, but your brain will force you to keep competing. It seems like amateur wrestling breeds and creates that mindset more than any other discipline in the world of combat sports.
Yep.
And
being bold to it now, I'll simply say, look at that basic end result. When you look at 9 out of the top 10 guys per weight class, elite, they're wrestlers.
Yep.
They're wrestlers that learn how to submit. They're wrestlers that learn how to strike. I coached at a couple of different universities. I worked at Arizona State. I worked at Michigan State. I used to referee challenge matches at the weight classes. And at the weight classes, these guys would be going back and forth, because they wrestled and practiced with each other so much that they knew each other's ability, to where they're negating each other and the frustration levels are building and building to the point that they break out into fisticuffs. And things like, and now you throw a wrestler in the world of no hold barred or mixed martial arts. The double leg takedown, because they're all these guys want to pull guard. It's like, guard? Guard this. Hammer fist, boom, right in the forehead right there, right in the and they could guard that now.
That's what happened to me.
And it neutralizes things.
And I want to get back to the book in a second, but I have to ask, because I'm going to probably put this show out on Monday or Tuesday of next week, because it's UFC 200. It's the biggest week of the year for MMA. And obviously, Brock Lesnar is the biggest star of them all. National champion in wrestling, one of the biggest stars, maybe the biggest star in the history of MMA. But just like you, he also has that pro wrestling background. And they're two totally different beasts, even though they're kind of the same. And he's coming just from pro wrestling to MMA. Do you look at that? And what are your thoughts as far as Brock transitioning and just kind of going straight into real fighting, having spent a couple of years now doing professional wrestling?
Well, something you probably don't know about my background, Mike, is I worked for the WWF, now known as WWE at one point in time.
Oh, yeah.
I was and still am, to my knowledge, the only non-exclusive professional wrestler ever.
Huh.
I could work for any company I wanted to, including WCW and ECW still existed at that time. Even while working for them, I was working for the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance, and NWA alone had 35 different promoters in it that I was working for. Give you an idea, while I was still under contract with the WWE, in one year, while I was still under contract with WWE, I had 8 fights in 1 year. And I went undefeated. Brock Lesnar has had 8 fights so far in his entire career. His fight coming up in UFC 200 will be his 9th. So I don't even want to be put in the same category as Brock Lesnar.
Well, you've certainly, you both have been UFC heavyweight champions, I guess. You've clearly had a much longer and more decorated career.
One of us can claim lifetime chemical free status. I doubt it's the other one.
I read a story, speaking of pro wrestling, that you, I don't want to say threatened, but basically knew that if you wanted to, you could have gone out at a Royal Rumble and beaten every single guy in a shoot.
What you're about to talk about, you understood. Yeah. Go ahead there, Mike.
I mean, I grew up watching pro wrestling. I remember Brawl for All and all that stuff.
But there's a story, I guess, that goes that you were going to be in the, you kind of threatened to be in the Royal Rumble and beat everybody up legitimately to just, you know, shoot on everyone. And
would you like the real version?
Yo, yeah, I want the real version. Yeah, please.
From the horse's mouth himself, or the beast's mouth? How's that? there comes a point in time when, as a professional wrestler, you're cycled through being a babyface or a heel, good guy or bad guy.
Right.
I was known as a good guy. I knew that somewhere down the road there would be this twist where they're going to turn me to a dark side, bad guy. And I had already put some preconceived ideas of what I could do and live with as the heel. All of a sudden, they're pitching these ideas of 666 across my forehead. Mark of the Beast.
Yeah.
Become an Undertaker, disciple, all this kind of stuff. I'm like, hey, guys, ain't going to happen. And so, I mean, I'll say that we were starting to get this little creative differences. Then all of a sudden, it's kind of like going, well, I can kind of see the writing on the wall, because they're like, they said, well, you know, Dan, we could start using you poorly. I go, what does that mean? They're like, well, we can have you start losing matches. And I'm like, oh, you mean you can ask me to lose a match? But where does it state anywhere in my contract? All it states is how many matches I'm going to give you. Doesn't say how many times I have to lose. And the Royal Rumble was right around the corner, and I thought about, because WCW still existed.
Right.
And it crossed my mind to call Eric Bischoff. And then, which was the whole WCW was financially backed by Ted Turner. And then simply said, I want both gentlemen there to say, what's it worth to you guys? When I go into the Royal Rumble in front of a live audience on a pay-per-view, and when it's time for Dan Severn to be tossed out of a ring, I turn fantasy into reality, and it's live in front of a live audience. So I clear the case, so I'll clear that ring out without a doubt.
Right.
And now I'm just waiting every 2 minutes for fresh meat. Now, everyone that's watching, everyone that's there, they'll think it's all part of the show. Mm-hmm. And if they send sheer force a mass, they'll eventually get me out of the. They would eventually have got me out of the ring. But they haven't got me out of the arena. So, Mike, how much do you think I could have gotten out of Ted Turner and Eric Bischoff for one night's work to show the competition maybe you should treat the hired hands a little better?
Yeah, I would guess at the height of the Monday Night Wars, that the way that they were throwing around money, especially Ted Turner, you would have probably gotten seven figures, I would guess.
It would have been worth a night's work, yeah.
Honestly, somebody that watched all that stuff growing up, it would have been really great if you had done that. I'm sure,
I turned out just, we basically came to agreements. Yeah. And life went on. I went on my way. They went on their way. I'll say the sad part about all that is I don't think that the company, I don't think Vince McMahon or the company realized what they had with me. I'm that old school cloth where a handshake and your word really means something. And to me, if you use me right, do you think I'm going to bite the hand that's feeding me? I made more money, and this is the really sad part, I made more money as a professional wrestler than I ever did as a cage fighter. That's almost like mind-boggling, because where do you pay the most price I'd say you're going to pay more price in a real cage fight. Although, in my circumstances, I've actually been hurt worse in my professional wrestling career.
Well, that's what happens when you're really good at, cage fighting, and you don't have to get thrown. Nobody ever threw you around in the UFC. Nobody ever suplexed you or anything. I mean, that's for sure. But
for stepping into cage just before turning 37 years of age back in 1994, the UFC, they never had age cracks, and I wasn't about to even start to crack them, but they had to start to distort that before, but I was just before turning 37 is when I started. So I defy the odds even there of starting a cage fight at that age. Lifetime chemical free. I think I've lived either four or five of my cage fight opponents and almost 30 of my professionals and partners, and none of them are older. And I plan on being around for a lot longer, and I'm not done competing yet. I still have a few more hurrahs in me.
That's
just in my age category, that's all.
Oh, hey, I mean, that's who you are. You're a guy that's competed, and now you've entered again the world of publishing. It's obviously a different world. When you are going through writing the book, was there anything that surprised you? Was it easier than you thought it would be? Tougher than you thought it would be? How did that whole process come about?
Well,
for
you? I had so much content. That's where Ian Douglas, I mean, he was just blown away with all the stories. The fact that I'm pulling stories out, talking about Cold War being in East Germany, West Germany, and you're like, what? And how were they born at those times? And like, what do you mean by this? It just kind of blew him away on the stuff, because I have experienced so much history. Seeing the Iron Curtain, Berlin Wall, being all these third world countries at the time, wrestling against the very best of the amateur wrestlers in their countries, beating people that I should have never been able to beat, but knowing that I could tap into this mental side that still served me so well in my cage fighting experience. Jim Brown is a guy who gave me the ring name, the Beast. He was one of the play-by-play commentators, and he was just kind of blown away that when I first showed up here, I'm wearing a sports jacket and a tie. And I wear glasses for distance. And his words is like, damn, he goes, when I first met you, he goes, I really didn't think that much about you. You're rather soft-spoken. You're kind of an intelligent, low-manner type of person. He goes, you kind of remind me of Clark Kent Superman. You take your glasses off, take your jacket off, and he says, here comes Superman. And now he goes, I've never seen someone go through a transition or to turn it on like that. He goes, how do you do that? I said, Jim Brown asked me a question like that. Wow. I was thoroughly pleased because I watched him when I was in high school. But he was in the NFL, with the greatest rushing record ever. It took him in almost an additional 10 years to play.
Jeez.
So I say that's a pretty down-put endorsement when you get an NFL Hall of Famer giving you your ring name.
Oh, I mean, and again, not to gush too much, but my best friend Tony and I talk a lot because we're both in our 30s, but we were just lucky enough to watch the sport from the beginning. And, I grew up, literally, I was watching you and Oleg Taktarov and Ken Shamrock, and I had no idea really what was happening. I just knew there was something special about it. And here you are now, somebody whose career, granted, you're obviously much younger, but you wrestled, or I should say competed, from Lyndon Johnson to Barack Obama, which is an incredible span of time if you really think about it. That's how long you've been around and competing at a very, very high level. And I imagine your book is just going to be full of fantastic stories.
Oh, look, that's what it is. I mean, it's a lot of stories, but it goes into different categories of there's amateurs in this, professional wrestling that, cage fighting this, and then there's a little bit of the growing up aspect right there. And then, then looking at, what's next for the Beast in his twilight years. So it's kind of, I'll say, only superficially touching each other because having over 1,000 pages. And on one page, there were multiple little mini paragraphs, but just enough verbiage. You know, it would be something like, Leipzig, East Germany, Russian negotiations, lots of vodka. Now, those three or four lines is an entire story, and that story did not need to go into this book.
Jeez. That actually kind of sounds like Bret Hart wrote his autobiography, and I guess it was like 1,500 pages originally, and he had more to write. And it seems like there's just some of you special guys who have this incredible life that basically cannot be told in one story. Like, you know, modern movies like to do the big trilogy, but your life story actually would be 6 or 7 movies, if we're being honest.
Well, okay, when you say that, one of the longest series of movies is the Rocky series.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Rocky IV, I happened to be up in Big Bear, California for an Olympic training camp. And a group out of Hollywood comes up there looking for the nemesis to go against Rocky. And there was another 220-pounder, and myself were two of the wrestlers that they brought in as potential candidates. And I met Stallone's wife at the time. I think it was Stasha Stallone at that point. And she looks at me and goes, oh, she says, you have much darker features, like Sly, you know. So, but, you know, it's kind of cool that I was one of the candidates, possibly to be, you know, Drago, I must break.
Wow. Wow,
I could have said that line.
You could
have. And I actually had capabilities of doing it, breaking them if I wanted to.
You could have changed the history of modern cinema in addition to changing the history of amateur wrestling and cage fighting. Is there anything you, in hula hooping, is there anything you haven't almost basically changed forever? Is there anything you want to change? Like, do you want to do Dancing with the Stars or, I don't know, Bob Ross painting?
I've actually thought about that, but the Andrews two-step would not be all that cool of a move out there, you know.
Well,
not all that smooth. I can't say that. It's, you know, the better half, she thinks that move pretty good, but maybe that's just her lying to me to keep his kosher.
Well, you've obviously given me more than enough of your time. I really want you to get, though, and, you know, give the hard sell, give the plug, because I cannot wait for your book to come out. Like, when I heard you writing a book, I'm like, oh, that's something to read. It's important to read, and this is a good book to read. Like, I'll find nieces and nephews and little cousins and be like, read this book, and I'll sit there and watch them read it and be like, become more of a man. You know, don't be like the modern millennials. Just read this and become more intelligent and strong. So tell everybody what they can experience and just plug everything you've got in the world.
Only thing I'm going to say about it is the title basically says it all. I mean, there's this more modern theme of, you know, that people like, you know, say keep it real, or the, you know, I'm the realest guy in the room, or, yeah, and that's what I could think of. Actually, it was Ian that he thought. He seen how more and more this was coming up as his catchphrase. And the one thing he knows about me, he says, Dan, he goes, you are that blunt and to the point guy. You are the guy that has done things. I'm time tested. I am walking history to have competed over 45 years, and I know I will make it another 5. I'll get it to my 5th decade. I know that already. That's a given. You know, the sad part is to simply say that sooner or later, your demise is going to happen. And so even as I think of my own demise, I'm like going, well, you know, I think I want to live to be 125.
I believe
and
that.
And at 100... Yeah. And at 125, Mike, I would like to have my life taken tragically and suddenly by a jealous husband.
My father used to say that exact same line. Oh, you guys are cut from the same cloth of just this old school.
She would have been a much younger woman. She would have been in her 90s, you know. But I just couldn't help myself. Her and her orthodontic stockings.
Well, I guess this is one of the part of the show you'll make sure your wife doesn't listen to or anything like that. But
well, no, I mean, she'll just look at me like, oh, you old goat.
Well, again, you know, is it dansevern.com? What is the name of the book?
Dansevern.com, and you know, the name of the book is just, it's called The Realest Guy in the Room. And I keep it real. I don't sugarcoat things. I'll say there are some rather some controversial type aspects. You know, there are some things because there are some comparisons between Brock Lesnar and myself, him calling himself the Beast, me being the Beast part of him. But I would, you know, to me, it's like there's been hundreds of Beasts before me, and there'll be hundreds of Beasts after us. But if you're looking at the sheer fact that I say that, you know, he has had 8 matches in his entire career. I had 8 matches in just 1 year, and I went undefeated in that same year on top of that. You know, going from the no holds bar era to the modern mixed martial arts, you didn't just throw a switch and a change overnight. It was changing state by state. I'd be in a state like North Dakota, and I'm thinking, gosh, I don't know if I could do this. Literally, as I'm holding my opponent either against the cage or taking them on down, I'd be looking at the referee and go, "Hey, ref, am I allowed to?" I'm tipping my hat to my opponent, but I still had that much control that he couldn't do anything about it. So I talked a little bit about Brock Lesnar. I talked a little bit about Hoist Gracie. I talked a little bit about Ken Shamrock, showing the difference between us. And the sheer fact that out of the top 3 guys in the UFC Hall of Fame, only one of us has never tested positive.
That is actually a very impressive statistic.
Now, again, I'm keeping it real. That's why, you know, Ian just come back and goes, Danny goes, you are the realest guy. You're keeping it real here right now. He goes, even when it came, I get thinking it should be like the life, you know, lifetimes or whatever, but, you know, to me, they all came across as boring, but as he was telling me more and more about this, I kept thinking, you know, I can live with that. I almost want to come up with some other really kind of bolder type of title, like, can you believe all this stuff? Well, I wasn't going to use the word stuff. Can you believe all this, you know, S-H-I-T here right now? And I got thinking, well, that might not be appropriate to some people might think that, because I have been competing so long. I've actually had some people go, there's no way it could still be you. You must have sung. Or something like that.
And you have a doppelganger.
I've been accused of having clones are out there doing things.
You and Tom Selleck.
Tom's younger brother. But, you know, there's even comparisons between in professional wrestling. You got Taz, who refers to himself as the human suplex machine. I'm thinking, well, pulls off suplexes. In real competition, too.
Oh, you and Anthony Macias. That was I remember seeing that going, holy cow, pro wrestling moves are real. It was incredible.
Oh, well, I mean, professional wrestling companies across the world are like going, yes, we have the guy now. He pulled off German suplexes. I'm thinking, well, no, in the amateur wrestling world, that's known as a belly to back suplex is what it's called. And that was my UFC number 4. I could tell people, I didn't train for 5 days. When they even asked me, what is your martial art? It was the first time I've ever been asked that question. Just 4 days ago, what's your martial art? I go, I'm an American wrestler. And they look at me because they had never heard this before. And they were bold enough to say, I've never heard of that. What's that? What does that do? I go, I'm not sure. I'm making it up as I go. Watch and find out. Because, I mean, you know, think about that. How many guys are going to train 5 days, an hour and a half a day. Never trained in a legitimate strike, never trained in a legitimate submission, and walking and just laying it on the ring against 3 men in one night. You know, my most memorable tournament was the Ultimate. Out of a 2-hour pay-per-view between my 3 opponents, I was in the octagon cage just over 1 hour.
Wow. I mean,
and that was no holds barred rules, and that was in Denver, Colorado, mile high elevation on top of that. Yeah, but that was one of the events I actually trained for. I had two training camps, used it for 5 days. I was like, that was a training camp. It was a joke. I had three professional wrestlers that, you know, they were screaming and squawking. It was comedy. It was slapstick comedy. It's really what that one was. But UFC 5, oh, I trained. I took 32 days out, Mike, and I trained to be a no-holds barred fighter. And then for the Ultimate, I trained for that one. The last match that I was supposed to have with Ken Shamrock, I took out 5 months of my life. You want to know what a dancer looks like after 5 months of training?
That's
I even scared myself looking in the mirror.
I can only imagine.
I stepped on the scale, even though he pulled out and Tank Abbott did not make it. They're like, well, yeah, off the show. I'm like, the hell I am. I go, I haven't busted my butt this hard. I will be at the weigh-ins. I will strip down to my skivvies, and I'm going to step on them scales. And I did. I showed up there. They still announced me. I stepped on the scales. Mike, I stepped on the scales at 236 pounds.
Wow.
I haven't been knocked down to 236 pounds since 1996.
That's like your prime, you know, competition weight, I would imagine, back in the 80s.
Back in the day, but like I say, it was I put in the time. I was ready. I was a wrecking machine. I was doing my slowest day was 2 days, two workouts a day. That was on a Sunday. The rest of the week was three workouts a day. Every Thursday, I did four workouts a day.
Well, Dan, you are a crazy man, and again, I want to let you go. But before we go, I got to ask, Dan Severn in his prime versus Brock Lesnar in his prime, do you beat Brock Lesnar?
Not even a contest.
That's all we need to say, everybody. Dan, again, we're going to have links to your book and everything. Everybody, if you're not going to buy Dan Severn's book, you're not really a fight fan. He is a legitimate legend. UFC 200 is in a couple of days. Honestly, there would not be a UFC 200 if there was not a Dan Severn. Dan, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. And to everybody listening, we'll talk to you guys in a little bit.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope.